HubZero.org, a platform for scientific collaboration.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Harmeyer. I'm the digital archivist in Archives of Special Collections within the Purdue University Libraries and the digital archivist on the PER project. Amy Hatfield was originally going to be giving a part of this presentation, but she could be here today. So I'll be taking over her part. And at the end, Brandon Beatty, who is a software developer within PER, will talk a little bit about how we're implementing OIIPMH to make data sets within PER more discoverable within the Purdue Libraries catalog in the future. So we're going to talk primarily about ISO 16363, how that is going to serve to make the PER a trusted digital repository so that we can make certain that these data sets are accessible not only when they're first published, but far into the future. I specialize in preservation as a digital archivist. Amy specializes in metadata as a metadata specialist. So as I go through the preservation part, I'll be really strong on, so bear with me if I miss a point or two on the metadata part. So as our colleague Courtney Matthews just talked about, he described PER and how it serves the research community. Once data is submitted into PER, strategies have to be in place to ensure this research data is accessible for the long term. Three components of this, preservation, metadata, and OIIPMH, act in tandem to provide long-term access to research data. And we're going to talk about how we're applying these methodologies within PER. As a digital archivist on the PER project team, I advise as to preservation best practices and create documentation regarding preservation tools and techniques. I will discuss the Brisdo preservation efforts and PER designed to guide these data sets. So first off, I thought I'd talk about why we need to preserve. Scholarly research necessitates the ability to refer back to things. You can't learn into the future unless you know what you've done in the past. And items accessible today, they're not necessarily going to be accessible in the future. I think we can all think of some software or something we maybe worked on 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago that if you try to load it now, you may have a hard time doing it. So obsolescence, technology, failures, any kind of disaster can damage or destroy. So effective preservation mitigates that eventuality. And I think it's important to note that physical backups, while they're integral to the preservation process, are not enough. A backup won't help you if the software you use to operate the item or the digital object itself is outmoded and the file cannot be read. So part of the migration I speak of here in the practices we take brings not only these items on the new physical media, but brings the digital objects themselves forward in format into the future. The first document created once to guide PER was the digital preservation policy. This policy is dictates sort of the management ideas and behind the content within the repository. This policy states that a focused attention to preservation is a quote-unquote essential component of PER services as enables long-term access, and as such, it requires attention throughout the data management process. And I think this is a key directive within this policy. And development of our long-term preservation strategies comes directly from this policy. Purdue University Libraries is committed to preserving these data sets for content of at least 10 years after publication, and the libraries has taken it upon themselves to be responsible for preserving this data within PER. So, how do you go from policies to being a trustworthy digital repository? It's a small task, right? As we found out over the course of the last year or so as we've worked on this. So via the mandate of the PER digital preservation policy, we know that a robust digital preservation system has to be implemented. And to follow, stringent preservation planning should come from an internationally recognized standard. And to that end, we're following ISO 16363, the audit and certification of trustworthy digital repositories, which provides specific metrics, point by point, as to how to establish a functional and reliable digital preservation environment. For effective long-term preservation, we need to establish a systematic way of moving digital objects into future-friendly formats. And to that end, preservation policies have been created based upon these specific directives. The policy drives the process of preservation throughout the life cycle of these data sets. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about some of the documentation I worked on as the digital archivist on the project. The two high-level documents we created were a preservation strategic plan. This lays out our overall objectives and lists imperative preservation activities. A secondary document, a little bit more specific, was our preservation strategies document, which determines specific strategies for preservation of each digital object and list preservation actions necessary for long-term preservation and access. And it's important to note preservation and access are used consecutively all the time in this because you cannot, there's no reason to preserve something if you can't access it, and you can't access something if you cannot preserve it. And that's an archival basic. I'm not sure any archivists are in the room, but I'm one of them, so I'm pretty strong on that one. Some of these strategies, for example, will include format recognition, backups, fixity checks, format normalization, and migration, as I mentioned earlier. Now, migration is twofold, as I mentioned, and when an event like a migration event occurs, these events are recorded in preservation metadata, which will be discussed a little bit further as part of our presentation. Now, as part of the ISO 16363, the OIS reference model, which was mentioned as part of Courtney's presentation during the document submission lifecycle, comes into play. This is another ISO standard that is which is the standard internationally recognized for digital preservation. Various preservation planning aspects, as you see on this chart, are modeled from producer all the way to consumer, including ingest, data management, storage, and access. These preservation planning and strategies are really good as high-level documents, and this here is a very high-level diagram. When you get into the nuts and bolts of things, it gets very tricky and very specific. You have a case-by-case basis at times, which we try to avoid, but there are moments when it does come down to something like that. Two of the big things we do when we talk about preservation strategies and activities are fixity checks and format checks. Digital objects must undergo fixity checks on a regular basis. And a fixity, just a quick definition for anyone who doesn't know, fixity is a property of an object when it is unchanged over time. So when an object comes in, you check, it is given a hash, and then that is checked at a later time against that hash. And if those two align, then your file is uncorrupted and unchanged, there's been no data loss. If those two hashes do not match, then you have run into a problem and you need to take action to replace that file, which we have stipulated in our policies that will occur if we find any data loss. Another aspect is file formats. Now, file formats, there's a myriad of file formats out there, we all know that. They need to be determined and validated to ensure long-term preservation. So when a file is brought in to PER, it is checked against the international registry, and based upon that knowledge, a preservation strategy is actioned determined by that file format. So if it's a legacy format that is no longer in use and there's an archival standard, we'll put things in place to migrate or normalize that file into a archivally friendly long-term format so it's accessible going forward into the future. It's important to note that as archival best practices change, these preservation actions will change. And archival best practices change, not, I would say, every year, but they change. With digital preservation is still changing and flowing and growing. It is going to be changing over time for sure. Getting down a little more specific into the OIS model is this concept of information packages, which is a group of digital objects you would find within a preservation system. To be really quick, there are three types of information packages. There is the submission information package, like the name says. It's what happens when you actually bring things in. This just includes digital objects and some descriptive metadata. When something is actually submitted and published, an archival information package is created. And this contains digital objects and, importantly, preservation descriptive information or preservation metadata. The PDI includes preservation metadata like fixity, reference, context, provenance, and access rights information. This is actually what carries the package that carries these documents forward into the future. Another note is that there's a dissemination information package, which is actually derived from the IEP, and this is the access piece. So when you click that download button from a publication, this is actually what you're accessing. You're accessing the DIP. So now this is a really high level and quick description of some of our preservation activities. So I'm going to go through and do my best to go through Amy's portion here on metadata. So what happens is, based on these policies I've created working with the PER project team, we've actually implemented some metadata schemas we're going to utilize to actually put this into action. Now, this is the colorful part of the presentation because Amy's a very colorful person. Mine was very dreary and drab. This is going to be very colorful, so I hope you wake up. Okay, this is the PER project team, by the way. Many of us are already here, but we have a mascot, apparently. So enjoy. This is an example, as you've seen with Courtney and Mike's presentation earlier, of a submission page for publications. This is just a quick synopsis of the types of fields you may see that will become descriptive metadata. This metadata is actually, once it's submitted, actually is brought into database tables, and each thing is routed to a specific table to be called at a certain time when necessary and needed. Our basic, we have a few metadata schemas we utilize. For the descriptive metadata, we use Dublin Core. You can see here, I'm not going to go through each one. You can see the table it's actually being written to. You can see the DC terms that's actually utilized, and sort of the description of how we're actually utilizing them within PER. For the DC terms, we use a qualified Dublin Core schema, which is, you can see here, it breaks down things like creator, contributor, description. We have three description fields based on the abstract, synopsis, and notes available within PER when you submit a data set. We have our DOI, our format, subjects, for example, our tags, etc. So we're going to talk a little bit about how this has actually been implemented with a visual display here. As we can see here, as Amy has overlaid the actual DC terms over where you would actually find it within the thing, within each page, so the title, it's self-explanatory. Description is a synopsis of description. Abstract is one another description. We'll go through here, and this is actually, you know, utilized for the subject terms, so the tagging. Here, the licensing is actually written, go down, is actually recorded. On the left here, everything is included within a METS wrapper. On the left side, you'll see the METS. Here, you'll start seeing the Dublin Core terms and where they actually are populated within the METS wrapper. After the Dublin Core, we utilize Premise for our metadata schema for preservation metadata. This is the administrative component of it. Within this, and it's lengthy, but anytime you would have a migration event, fixity check, any of those preservation activities I mentioned, this is recorded within the preservation metadata within the schema as needed. Also includes technical metadata at length and provenance metadata, including validation. And then provenance metadata, which also includes migration. This is a quick, so let's say you have the metadata on the left, you have your digital objects on the right. We're going to implement it into a Bagot. Put one in, put the other in. You make your migration copies. If you need a dissemination package, you have it right there. Poof, magic. We have our dissemination AIP. This becomes fully searchable within PER. However, we would like to make this discoverable through other systems. And now Brandon's going to give a quick talk because he's the developer for this specific aspect of using OIAPMH within PER.
Hello. I guess we only have 3 minutes, so I'll be quick on this one. When a data set is published within PER, we want its metadata to be totally exposed or discoverable. There's a couple ways to do this, but we chose to use OIIPMH, which is the Open Archives Initiative Protocol for Metadata Harvesting, which provides an application-independent interoperability framework based on metadata harvesting. There are two types of participants. One is a data provider, which is a system that basically exposes your metadata, and a service provider, which uses that harvested metadata to create a value-added service. In our situation, PER is a data provider, and something like a library catalog would be your service provider. As you can see, a library catalog would issue an HTTP request to the data provider, which then returns an XML document. We created a custom, easy-to-use Hub0 component that makes any record within the hub a record for a harvester. So initially, we hard-coded it for PER's publications table, but now it's on a new version, which is completely customizable, so any hub can use this and become a data provider themselves. So any hub now can use it, and now that it's customizable, hopefully any hub in the future will also be able to use it. Oh, thank you. Yes.
The question was, how do we actually preserve the hashes? That Or how, what was that? Is that clear enough, or would you like to rephrase it, or is that fine? Okay, it's actually the numerical value of the hash is included within the preservation metadata, and is actually included within the AIP. So that is actually always with the information, the digital objects. Each digital object receives its own hash, as well as the AIP receives a hash. So we can check each digital object on a set schedule, as well as the AIP on a set schedule. If we find any errors in one or the other, we will replace, in the case of an AIP, the entire AIP, or in the case of a digital object, that one digital object. So the question, if I understand you correctly, not being a programmer, being an archivist, the question is, how do we actually implement the doing this, or? Yeah. One of the things about digital preservation is that we recognize that standards will consistently change, I mentioned earlier. And so in our policies, we actually have it written down, and of course, it's too fine of a point to actually bring up here, but we have policies written that we actually make allowances for that to actually be in place. And so we recognize that there will be different changes in the way these hashes are created, the way they're actually utilized, and things like that. And so we have contingencies in place. So when a new standard comes out, for example, we actually will make that implementation and then move that forward as well.
You have to migrate information, or, for example, the algorithm improves, or then you have to change or preserve the hash, or the way that the algorithm calculated, or the hash, or things like that.
The general idea is to mitigate for any of well-known preservation issues. So if you have a new TIFF, for example, a new TIFF standard come out or something like that, you know how to migrate from TIFF 6.0 to TIFF 7.0, for example, or something like that. So it is a continually adjustable process. The idea being it's short-term solutions for a long-term preservation, and I guess that's probably the best way to answer your question. Hopefully, we keep making adjustments in digital preservation as we go along, so that within 100 years, we're not looking back 100 years, we're looking back just 2 to 4 to 6 years. Yes. Could you repeat the question, actually? Yes. Okay, so what standards and guidelines do we have for actually migration, what is migrate, and how that is done? Is that the question? We actually create those standards. There's archival best practices that are based on discussions that, within the archival community that are discussed as to what the best practice is. Generally, it's an uncompressed file that is widely accessible by most people possible. And that is the file of choice. Now, there are multiple files that can suit that. For example, with image files, it's TIFF and currently TIFF and JPEG 2000. Video files right now, the MPEG 264 is actually it, but 265 just was discussed a few weeks ago. These things are constantly being updated and discussed. So I keep covering on the same point, but we make decisions based upon the best knowledge at the time. And then you migrate to that as the time comes that you see it's necessary to do so. You don't necessarily do it the moment a new standard comes out. You plan for the contingency that a new standard is going to come out, and when time is right, you have the resources, the situation determines that you have the time, resources, or you must do it, then you migrate these items forward. Any questions?
Final question.
Yes.
At some point, like, you know, vocabulary should change as well, right? Mm-hmm. In the future, some term bifurcates into two subclasses, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
We can't arbitrarily make that decision in the future, which sometimes that would be.
Agreed. That's an ongoing discussion within archival best practices, actually. The question was essentially, what happens in the future if a file, and once again, the terminology may, I mean, under the exact terminology, but when practices dictate that a new file version is semantically different from what you had in the past. Is that clear enough? The best answer I can give you right now is that is a concern that actually is ongoing in archival communities, and that there may be two best practices that come from that. For example, right now there may only be one that you migrate to. In the future, with semantic differences, you may be able to migrate to both. You may find it necessary to migrate to both based upon your resources or what is perceived to be the best for your the future, I guess. It's a very general, but the best answer I think we have right now in the archival community.
Okay.